Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
yeah, we did. We started to burn too many things we found. One thing we could burn, by the way, is the new Trump budget, which is just coming out today. Total garbage, mean-spirited, vicious, anti-human, everything that you would expect from Donald Trump, including $120 million to try and revive the idiotic, failed, worthless, Trump-sponsored Yucca Mountain waste dump for high-level radioactive waste in Nevada, which is already a failure. Utterly insane. Slashing NPR, slashing PBS, slashing all sorts of programs for human services, for children. It is, if anybody doubted the utter evil of Donald Trump, just take a look at this budget. It's absolutely completely insane and completely indefensible. Everything that all the worst stuff that we could thought we could get from Donald Trump is there and more. This man has no redeeming social value, completely void of empathy, compassion, common sense, you name it. This budget has it in there. It's utterly sick. And we'll discuss it some more. Do we have Roy Morrison with us?
He is here.
Roy is here. Have you seen this budget, Roy?
I have been looking at dribs and drabs as it's been coming out. And, you know, essentially it's the wish list of the fossil fuel and nuclear industry. And, you know, it represents complete embrace of pollution and corporate profit, not even corporate profit, just inherited wealth as opposed to human values. You know, some of the opponents of the budget are going to be companies that are in green businesses. You know, so it's not that, you know, that Trump is a tool of industry. Trump is a tool of the sort of worst fantasies of going back to the 1950s, you know, when petroleum ruled and everything looked, you know, production without consequence and without growth without end and without quality. You know, and that's the sort of dream of, you know, the 10-year-old Donald Trump and his father, the master builder, you know, when white people ruled and everyone else kept in their place. You know, so that's what he's about. It's not worth paying much attention to as a serious politician. He's a reactionary moron. It's a technical term.
He's president of the United States. It's utterly insane. And, you know, as we sort out how he became president, and I will go into this for a minute, because I saw a very good article by a guy named Ted Rall, who's also a cartoonist, and he did the cartoons for Greg Palast's book on ballots and bandit thieves, you know, election theft. But the reason Donald Trump is in the White House is because the Democratic Party, the corporate Democratic Party, refused to make any kind of compromise with Bernie Sanders and the grassroots upheaval that accompanied his campaign. I mean, it's not an accident that the largest, best organized, and most enthusiastic left-wing uprising in the history of the United States, certainly since the Vietnam War, just happened and is immediately succeeded by, followed by this harsh, reactionary right-wing coup d'etat, essentially. And what really allowed it to happen was the corporate Democratic Party unwilling to embrace anything of the Bernie Sanders campaign. I mean, Donald Trump is in the White House because Hillary Clinton refused to run with Bernie Sanders, or she had nominated Bernie for vice president. If the corporate Democratic Party had not kicked the tens of millions of young people who were out campaigning for him in the teeth, Trump wouldn't have got anywhere near the White House. So, aside from the fact that the election was stolen with the mass disenfranchisement of black people and throughout the country and Hispanics, and the manipulation of electronic voting machines. And so now we pay the price for that kind of arrogance.
And it was really clear that, at least to me at the time, that the way to stop Trump was for Hillary to pick Bernie to be the vice presidential candidate. You know, and that would have made all the difference in the world. You know, but this is, obviously the corporate Democrats thought that they could do what they were planning to do. And it turned out in their arrogance, you know, that the people that Bernie could talk to, because he tells the truth and he's a plain spoken guy, were the people that voted for Donald Trump in many cases. You know, so we got what the consequence of, you know, Obama's bailing out the banks and leaving the homeowners to their mercies. You know, that started it. You know, instead of perp walks for the banksters, you know, they kept their jobs and their bonuses and their billions. You know, and so that's the start of the avalanche, which concluded with, you know, getting rid of Bernie and embracing, you know, business as usual. And in desperation, people picked Donald Trump, you know. And
well, they didn't, though. And even that's not true. I mean, Hillary won the election by 2.8 million votes and completely disappeared. I know Roy Morrison, my old buddy from the Clamshell Alliance, we're going to talk about your great book, on the environment here. And we'll have a good ecological sustainability future. But you and I go way back, and this horrible budget has just come out. And it just angers me beyond, you know, any rational thought. And by the way, for those of you who hear me crunching, I am eating chips and salsa. I just got done teaching, and I am hungry. So if you hear chomps on the audio here, it's some really good Trader Joe's chips and some really good fresh salsa. So I invite you to join me, but not physically possible. So you can just fill in the blanks. But, you know, this budget really is the most substantial manifestation of the horrendous stab in the back that was perpetrated by the Democratic Party against this grassroots movement. I mean, I think the bottom line is that the corporate Democrats actually are more comfortable with Donald Trump in the White House than they would have been with Bernie Sanders as vice president. Now, I can't make the definitive case that Bernie would have beat Trump in a head-to-head presidential race. I actually have my doubts about that. But I have zero doubt, and I've never met anybody who I've talked to with who doubts that if Hillary had nominated Bernie, that they would have won in a walk. I mean, it's very clear. And her refusal to nominate Bernie and pick the stiff guy, whoever he was, Tim Kaine, who will disappear from history, who's even more corporate and more conservative than she was just a flat-out statement to the grassroots, millennial-based, democratic upheaval that Bernie ignited, that we don't care about you. We're corporate. We own the Democratic Party. And we don't need you to run. And if we lose, we don't care because we have more in common with Donald Trump than we do with Bernie Sanders. And with the movement that he represented. And now we see this budget, and you know, it's worse than anything Reagan did. You know,
Reagan was a politician, and he knew how to make compromises, and make deals, and he could sit down with Tip O'Neill, and they could craft something which was not necessarily horrendous. you know.
Well, a lot of it was horrendous, but, you know.
Right, part of it was, but you know, it things are as a matter of degree, you know, and the there's, you know, I mean, they put this budget out, you know, with the notion they know it's dead on arrival, you know, that it's that a lot of the funding cuts are going to get restored for some things and not for other things, you know. So, like, when they zeroing out the idea they want to get rid of energy star efficiency. Well, all the people who make appliances and things that use electricity love Energy Star because it gives consumers confidence that they can buy it and it's efficient. You know, so it's that kind of thing that there's going to be, you know, pushback on various levels. You know, the things where they're not pushback, that's where, you know, the poor and innocent who don't have enough political power are going to get crushed and killed. You know, so that, you know, they want to get rid of Medicaid. Well, there's a lot of pushback on that because the Republican governors in states say, you know, where are we going to get the money to deal with this? Where the hospitals say, we're going to go out of business. You know, you can't. You know, so when, in some areas there's pushback, you know, but in other areas, great evil will be done. You know, and we'll find out about it after it's done.
I mean, really, I love the fact. I mean, I was just looking through it. I'm writing a piece about this, about the budget for progressive.org, the old Progressive magazine. And I was just going through the budget and saw they came up with $120 million for Yucca Mountain. I actually started to laugh about that. That was really funny. He wants to eliminate or cut way back on auto efficiency standards, miles per gallon. Now,
right.
We've been through this twice already. You know, in the 70s, people said in the middle of the oil embargo, well, maybe you might consider building fuel-efficient cars. I know it's a leap, but gasoline has just gone to $10 a gallon or whatever. Maybe we ought to have smaller cars. And Detroit, in its infinite wisdom, said, nah, we'll continue to build really big cars. And then came Toyota and Honda and, you know, gutted out the Rust Belt. Just basically
right.
Hollowed out the Rust Belt. Then, in the early 2000s, late 90s, Amory Lovins and other people said, hey, you know, there's these things called hybrids. Maybe you ought to consider building hybrid cars. And again, Detroit said, nah, we're not going to do that. And, you know, there are 3 million Priuses on the road in the United States.
I drive
made
one.
In Japan. You drive one, Mazel Tov. And so, you know, and now here we go. We have electric cars. Now, anybody with half a brain can look at an electric car versus a gas-fired car and pick which one is going to be the future. Electric
right.
cars have virtually no moving parts except for the wheels. And, you know, they don't have gas. They don't have spark plugs. They don't have oil to change. They have all this crap. There's no engine in the front to kill you. When you're hit, the you know, the whole apparatus is on the bottom of the car. They weigh three quarters of what a gas-fired car is. They are they're at least they're as much as 4 times more efficient.
Right. So you're basically paying like 75 cents equivalent a gallon to run it, as opposed to 2, 3, 4, 5. You know,
yes.
You know, it's just, you know that doesn't seem to have gotten through to people sufficiently clearly, you know, that, I mean, that's the point, you know, of efficient renewable energies. It's not just, it's not a charity act to help the planet. It's self-interest, you know.
Well, the weird thing is, Roy, and you and I have been in the anti-nuclear movement since before God. And what seems to happen, and you've got this book, Sustainability Sutra, what seems to happen is that Mother Earth has decided that what's good for her is also good for the economy. I mean,
yes.
Everything we have done to oppose nuclear power, and of course Trump loves nuclear power to the extent that he knows anything about it, which is zero, but nonetheless, somebody told him, somebody on Fox News must have said they like nuclear power. And so Trump has decided that nuclear power is the way to go. And so... but everything we've said about nuclear power, that it was going to be bad for the economy, that it was going to be bad for jobs. Not only was it going to destroy the earth, but, you know, all these things, has proven to be true. And all of our opposition to nuclear power and our advocacy for renewable energy has turned to be out to be exactly the right thing for the economy.
Yes.
For a capitalist economy, you know, it is, if we had every cent that has been spent on nuclear power has been bad for the capitalist economy. And had we every cent been spent instead, as was advocated in 1952, by the way, in the Paley Commission report, been spent for renewable energy, you know, we'd be sitting pretty. We wouldn't be global warmed. We would be, we'd have full employment economy, and we'd be prosperous as hell. And yet here it is, 2016, 2017, and these morons are still pushing 1950s technology from automobiles.
Right. Well, but the global picture is changing. I mean that's the good news. You know that we, you know, if you, and the state picture is changing. You know, so that while Trump is calling for, you know, a return to yesterday, places like California are saying, let's go to 90% renewables, you know, and not just California, you know, Massachusetts, states all over the place, you know, even Florida and Georgia are making big investments in PV. You know, so it's...
Well, wait, you got to say what that is.
Oh, photovoltaic.
What's PV?
Yeah.
Photovoltaic cells. Photovoltaic cells, folks, for the three or four of you who don't know.
Right. So you can generate solar electricity.
You got to remember, Boyd, I teach college, and I never assume that my students know anything. So if you want to use acronyms on this show, you got to explain what they are.
That's right, because I live in an acronym world now.
Yeah, right.
Everybody talks. So here's what my life is like today. You know, for example, about the renewable stuff that's going on. I'm working on a project to build like large scale solar electric system at jails in Massachusetts, big ones, you know, 5 megawatts, 5 million watts, you know, and that the income from that will help fund a program in aquaponics and hydroponics for the jails and an education program to train the prisoners in useful things like.
All right, Ray, you gotta remember, you gotta explain aquaponics and hydroponics.
Okay, aquaponics, you know, so that now you can commercially and efficiently, for hydroponics, there's a company called Freight Farm that they took large packing crates and they turned it into a compact system that you can grow lettuce and microgreens using LED lamps commercially. You know, and it works. It's becoming, you know, it's part of the urban farming movement, vertical farming movement, you know, farming without soil, you know, either using water or having things hanging in moist air. And the aquaponics is to grow fish, usually tilapia, in tanks and use the waste from the fish to fertilize growing vegetables.
Wow.
So, the notion is, you know, is that, you know, and that 5 megawatt, that big solar array is going to sell the energy to a community solar system of people living in poor neighborhoods who will buy the energy at a discount, but they won't just buy the energy because of the way the finances can be arranged. They will end up owning the system to build equity for themselves and their families. You know, so what we're looking at for renewables is the potential for a real economic transformation that the ownership of the power plants, the renewable power plants, can be owned by the people who use the energy. You know, that's the big secret that hasn't come out yet. You know, that if you're putting up money to buy energy, you're in the position to come together and not only buy the energy, but buy the facility that produces the energy.
Are you doing this tangibly somewhere?
Yes, that's what I'm doing now.
Where?
You know, in Massachusetts. Because the economics of solar electricity in Massachusetts and other places is exceptionally good. You know, and so typically in the past, in the last several years, like had it always been, investors come in and build the plant, and then they sell it to other investors who want to profit from the plant once it's built, and they sell the energy to someone, and they get all the various profits from running the plant. But the reality of it is now that if these plants sell energy on the use of what's called the feed-in tariff, you get a long-term 20-year contract at a good price to sell the energy to the utility, and that you can take that piece of paper to the bank, and now you can finance the purchase of it if you have that piece of paper. You know, for example, the 1 megawatt solar array produces around 1.2 million kilowatt hours a year. And if you, under the new rules we have here, you can be able to sell that electricity for as much as 35 cents a kilowatt hour to the utility. So that's, you know, it's enormous potential cash flow, you know, and that establishes the basis for a cooperative of energy users to own that megawatt system. So that's what I'm working on. You know, so, and I'm also working on looking at using green biodiesel to mass produce it and use it for heating.
Well, what's green biodiesel?
Oh, well, the simplest thing you can do is you have organic waste and you compost it, and it produces methane, and you collect it. And then you can also liquefy it to use it as a liquid fuel, or you can just put it into the gas distribution system as opposed to fossil fuel natural gas.
Well, how do you produce it? How does it get produced?
Green biomass? It rots. You know, the friendly bacteria rot it, you know, and turn it to gas. That's why, you know, when a cow burps, methane comes out.
Yeah. All right. So that's why I'm a vegan, in part, because I don't want to be eating those burping cows. We're talking to Lori Morrison, author of Sustainability Sutra, one of the old-time Clamshell Alliance guys who's been with us forever. Where are you living now? Where are you speaking to us from?
I'm living in Newton, Massachusetts.
Okay.
I was living in New Hampshire until about 5 years ago, and then for various reasons, I'm in Massachusetts. And my book, you can get it on Amazon.com or your local bookstore, or you can go to the Indigo independent bookstore website and can order it through them.
How is this published? Who published the thing?
Select Books in New York.
Select?
Select. And so they have a new series, of which my book is the first, on ecological change.
All right. Sounds good to me. You like them? You like working with them?
Yes, but the thing is, what everyone has told me about writing, every time I've written a book is you don't really expect to make a lot of money by writing books.
That's an understatement.
So my mission is after writing the book is what I'm doing now is to get the word out, and to help people understand that, the times are desperate in the United States, both in the short term and the long term. I mean, the times would have still been desperate if Hillary Clinton became president. I think that's the interesting advantage of a monster like Trump in power, that all the hypocrisy is uncovered, we were happy going along, with the modest agenda, offered by the Democrats, not like the kind of dramatic and fundamental changes that we needed to have, to prevent, global ecological and climate catastrophe. We need to act where we are, to look at what the states are doing, look at what, there's now the I Matter movement of young kids that's starting to pop up, saying that towns and cities where, need to look at what their climate consequences are and come up with plans to reach a sustainable future. And that's what has to happen. From wherever we are, we have to understand what's happening in our house, in our town, in our city. And one of the things that I'm interested in is the notion that people understand what a sustainable level of carbon dioxide is personally. And that's approximately 3 tons of carbon per person per year. Because if you had if you had 7 billion people in the world averaging 3 tons per year, that would come out to 21 gigatons. That's a lot of carbon, and that's about the amount that the Earth naturally recycles. So if we can't reach 21 gigatons, eventually we're going to be in really big trouble. We're in the 40 to 50 gigaton range and rising. So the number that, that everyone hears, we've gone over 400 parts per million and this is a global problem. It's hard to figure out that what I do is going to have some effect on thinking about 400 gigatons a year globally. But in fact, that global total is really the sum total of what each of us do. So that if we can, that's why, we should understand the consequences of what we do. So that if you have an electric vehicle that's powered by an electric grid, the amount of carbon dioxide it produces is nominal. If you have an electric car powered by a fossil fuel grid, you've cut the emissions from your car by about 50% because it's much greater, it doesn't use gas, and it's much, much more efficient. So that, we should be heating our houses with heating and cooling our houses with heat pumps instead of burning fossil fuels. The most efficient oil burner or gas burner is like 90% efficient. Yeah, but an electric heat pump, an air-to-air heat pump, is like 300% more efficient because it's taking heat out of the air and it's not burning anything. It takes advantage of the second law of thermodynamics. And I won't attempt to explain the second law, but basically, we need to be looking at things that are several times more efficient, and that's possible. In other words, we're not trying to get from 85% efficient oil burners to 90% and say, wow, that's terrific. We're looking at going from 85% You know, so if you have most people have a air conditioner. That's, you know, that's an example of the heat pump. The air conditioner takes heat out of the house and dumps it outside. You know, and you'll see the energy efficiency rating on the thing, and it will say 12. You know, so it will get rid of 12,000 BTUs of heat out for every kilowatt hour you put in, or 3,400 BTUs. So in other words, it moves four times as much energy as you put into it. You know, so that's the kind of thing that if we're going to survive, we need to be way smarter and more efficient. And of course, that's precisely the kind of programs that the Donald is trashing. You know,
right.
You know, so that on the other hand, you know, that you have a regime in power for a few years does not, you know, turn back the tide, the global tide of transformation. You know, the issue is, you know, is it already too late? You know, are we reached, you know, at what point do we go over the edge? And there's, you know, but we can't live on that. We can't think like that. What we, you know, because we'll never know. You know, what we can do is we have to start where we are, where we live, and to understand what's happening in our community, and then take steps collectively to say, no, wait, we want to do things differently. You know, we want to have efficient renewable energy. You know, we want to have better forestry, better agriculture that's sustainable. We don't want industrial pollution poisoning us. You know, if you're going to produce something, there's got to be on the basis of working towards zero pollution and zero waste. You know, it's not, the issue isn't, you know, you can run a plant with the worst kind of chemicals like vinyl chloride, bad stuff, strong carcinogen, terrible thing, and produce polyvinyl chloride. You know, and now it's produced in towns in Louisiana and Texas that are typically African Americans, and most of the people who work there are local, and people, the workers are poisoned, the communities are poisoned. You know, the plant is lightly regulated by the EPA, even in the good old days. You know, but you could run that plant in a way that you could work in it and not get poisoned. You know, and you could not allow any measurable vinyl chloride gas to leave the plant. You know, or you could, you know, you can have, you know, double filter systems and, you know, and secure pipeline systems that, you know, and negative pressure systems, you know, that you have to have, you know, that make the plant a safe place to work and a safe place to live nearby. That's an industrial ecology. You know, of course, you know, you can also say, well, we don't want to mess with vinyl chloride. There's better things to use that are not toxic, and we'll use them because vinyl chloride is a poison. But the issue comes out, in my view, is if you had to pay the real cost of stopping the pollution that you're creating, it's almost certain that there'll be a much more non-toxic and ecologically sound alternative that will emerge. You know, so
well, what are those alternatives? Roy Morrison, author of Sustainability Sutra, what exactly is the Sustainability Sutra? If you have alternatives to polyvinyl chloride, which pray God you do. I mean, I was involved in the anti-chloride campaign at Greenpeace, and we wanted zero chloride. So
right.
what is your mega answer here to our flirting here at the edge of extinction? What's
right.
the answer? What's
well,
the
I think the general theme is to say, you know, to that economic growth has to mean ecological improvement. You know, so that if you're going to make money by doing things, the consequences have to be an improvement, not just in growth of finance capital, money, but you also have to have an improvement in natural capital, you know, the ecology. you know, so that if you, you know, so, you know, for example, if I build a lot of solar electric and I shut down the fossil fuel plants, that's economic growth that results in ecological improvement. You know, if we have zero nukes, zero fossil fuel plants, you know, it's trillions of dollars of productive investment that will give millions of people's jobs and slash enormously the destruction of our planet. You know, so that's, you know, so that we need to view that, you know, it's not a, the major question before us is the quality of what economic growth is. And in order for it to work, we need, the market needs to send clear price signals to people who are in business so that if you use, you know, so that sustainable goods should become cheaper, gain market share, become more profitable, you know, polluting and unsustainable goods will become more expensive, lose market share and lose money. You know, the market is very smart. You know, no one's going to say, hey, I got a great idea. I want to do a lot of polluting and lose a lot of money because I think pollution is great, you know, and I'm going to go to the bank with my business plan and they'll say, oh, no, thank you. The numbers don't work for us. You know, and so the problem is, you know, is that there are strong interests of the polluters and poisoners who are saying, you know, don't establish these market rules. You know, keep things the way they are, cut back regulations instead of strengthening them. But what I'm talking about is not just regulation. It's not saying how much you can pollute. What I'm saying is that the notion is that we need to have a system that it's not economic to poison anymore. You know, and if you do poison, you get seriously penalized and put in jail. And the Chinese had a, you know, sometimes they dealt with people who pollute, they shoot them.
Well, that's an interesting solution here.
You know, and in the Basque Country, in Spain, there was a lot of opposition to a nuclear plant when I was visiting there. And the Basque group, ADA, their solution to building the nuclear plant was they murdered the chief engineer at the plant.
Oh, my God.
No one volunteered to take his place. You know, so, I mean, that's not what I'm suggesting, but the point is that there needs to be strong sanctions on people who pollute, and there needs to be, you know, like every polluting plant we have is not a criminal plant, almost all of them. They're all approved by the EPA. They're licensed to poison. You're saying, yes, you know, the coal plant that's still running in New Hampshire, the Bow plant, it meets all regulation. In fact, they put more regulations on it. They made them put in a scrubber to get rid of some of the mercury. You know, and the Bow plant can proudly say, we are 100% in compliance with all regulation. You know, and yet they're both continuing to pour out carbon dioxide and microparticles that cause asthma in kids and bad lung problems in people. And they're also getting subsidized by the state now because coal is more expensive than competing fuels. And, you know, and they have the power to, you know, con the state into saying, oh, it's better to give them some kind of economic bail. And that seems to be happening with nukes now in various parts of the country, that the nuke plants that can't stay in business are saying, we need a subsidy because we're not a carbon-producing generator, and therefore you should treat us as if we were a solar electric plant. You know, so that's in the principle.
Quite amazing. Yeah, it's quite amazing the economics of it. And what's really happening now, Roy Morrison, author of Sustainability Sutra, is that the whole economics, as we started off talking in the beginning, the whole economics of the landscape and energy and other ecologically sensitive industries, but especially energy, has completely changed. And what we have are these, you know, I hate to badmouth the Neanderthals, but that's the term we use. The Koch brothers, Donald Trump, Vladimir Putin, they're all totally embedded in the obsolete technologies of fossil fuels and nuclear power. And right. Those of us who are arguing for green sustainability with electric cars and photovoltaic cells and windmills, we are the ones who are the ones who have the arguments that are economically sound. And we're the capitalists. With
right.
the vision,
well, that's,
actually.
Yeah, I mean, globally, much more money is flowing, nationally and globally, much more money is flowing into investment in renewables than in fossil fuels. I mean, that's extraordinary. You know, that's an enormous transformation, and many, not just nuclear plants are being canceled or closed, but many coal plants are being canceled, closed, and abandoned. You know, so that the, you know, in China, the China National Grid, which is the world's largest utility company, with over a million employees. So
really,
yeah. So I 3-4 years ago, I made a proposal to China Grid. We came up with a model for an East Asian super grid. You know, using high voltage DC transmission to be able to transmit renewable power from where it was generated to where we're going to use it. And, you know, we would establish a national network that you could, you know, be 100% renewable, because when you do this on large scales, you know, when the wind is blowing in one place, it's not blowing the other place, you know, so everything balances out much more easily and you need much less backup power. So I made this proposal and they were excited for, you know, 6 months, and then they became unexcited. Okay, so then the next thing I heard was one of my associates, Gregor Such, who's a European scientist who's one of the leaders in developing supergrid, became a consultant to China. And in this past year, the head of China Grid is saying they want to lead the way in wiring the world in a renewable supergrid. You know, so this stuff is happening. You know, the Europeans are building the supergrid. You know, in California, they're developing, and the Northwest, they're developing supergrid type interconnections. You know, so that.
Well, tell me, what is the difference between the supergrid and the regular grid?
Well, the supergrid is predicated on the conventional grid has AC transmission, because it's more efficient over it's cheaper, you know, to build than DC, because DC you need thicker cables and it's more complex to put power in and out of it at particular stations. So that, but when you have the supergrid, you have very high voltage DC, which DC doesn't have the problem of creating a lot of fields around it, so it's much safer for people who are near it in terms of effects from that. But also, you can move really huge amounts of power long distances on it. You don't have much voltage drop on it. And they've figured out ways of tapping in and out of it that's much more efficient. So it's possible now to network this system. Now, you know, there's a lot of debate on to what extent a supergrid is necessary, because if you have a lot of decentralized renewables, you know, so if every house had a roof that was made out of, had PV on it or made out of the new Tesla solar shingles, you know, and there was a lot, and there's new micro wind technology that you can have in your backyard, little vertical access wind turbines, that if you had a lot of, and fuel cells, et cetera, if you had a lot of distributed small-scale generation, maybe you don't need much of a supergrid. You know, and so the, and the small-scale generation, you know, you can use to form microgrids that can be in the, that can become independent of the larger regional grid if there's problems with the power. So I'm also working on a project working on that. But I mean, the basic underlying principle is that the renewable future will be very much electric. That electricity is going to, renewable electricity is going to run our cars, heat, cool, light our houses, power our factories. We're not going to be dependent on, you know, 20 coal and nuclear plants to provide our electricity in a region. You know, there's going to be millions of points of renewable generation. You know, and some of them will be coming from, you know, large off-scale offshore wind farms or wind farms on the prairie or large photovoltaic arrays. But also, every house is going to have its own, some degree, almost every house is going to have its own degree of self-generation. You know, that you can also plug your electric vehicle into your house to charge your house from your electric vehicle and charge the grid through your, when you're filled up and the grid needs more power, the power can go in the other direction, you know, so that you don't need to turn on natural gas peaking turbines, because if you've got, you know, we have 100 million vehicles in this country or so, or 200 million vehicles, if they all have, they're all electric and they have batteries and can be plugged in and go in both directions, you know, that's an enormous balancing resource for the grid of the future. And this isn't pie-in-the-sky technology. This is, you know, the latest versions of the electric cars are coming out with that capacity to both be charged and to feed power back into the grid. I think Nissan, the new Nissan, is going to be the first one. But it's, you know, so that's the future.
Yes, absolutely. We're talking with Roy Morrison, author of Sustainability Sutra, and, you know, about the future of electricity and survival on this planet on the day when they trump the loathsome, disgusting, retrograde Trump budget has come out. What's one of the things that's interesting, Roy, is where the other countries of the world are going. I know it's very hard for Americans to understand that there actually are other countries in the world, but Germany has made its decision to head into the world of renewables, as have a number of other European countries, and apparently Costa Rica now also is going to go 100% renewable. Can you tell us, and do you talk in your book, and can you tell us about how it's going in Germany, the energy beam, the conversion to 100% renewables?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen the latest material, but essentially all a large number of countries, you know, like England, France, and Germany, that meeting renewable goals are, you know, are fundamental by law, you know, and they all have serious plans, you know, and they're shutting down the coal plants, they're shutting down the nuke plants. I mean, you know, there's still problems in England because the conservative government tried to make a deal with France and China to build some new nuclear plants at an enormous cost, you know, guarantee an enormous price. And, you know, and I think that that's probably not going to happen because the more the economics and the stupidity of it come out, you know, so that, you know, so recently, you know, places like Germany and Denmark have produced all their power from renewables. You know, so they didn't need any fossil fuel backup. You know, so that's when you start to network solar and wind. You know, that they're complementary and have storage resources. You know, the existing fossil fuels fade into the background, and that will continue to happen. You know, so there's no, you know, there's no essential, there's no technological reason for us not to quickly embrace a renewable transformation, to move, you know, quickly to the point where, you know, that, you know, we close, obviously, the first target is to get rid of the coal plants, you know, but, and then the next, you know, and to reduce the natural gas contribution, and to understand that as sort of as a minor transitional thing that might be needed, and then to get rid of it all, you know, but instead, you know, the intention, if the world is left to Donald Trump and the Koch brothers, but, you know, Donald Trump is just like a passing fever. But these other guys, you know, I mean,
well,
Donald Trump could be gone in 3 months. You know, it'll be President Pence, and maybe he'll be gone too, and it'll be President Ryan, which might make us miss Trump, because,
yeah,
you know, Trump is a loony, and Ryan is evil.
Yeah. Well, they're both evil, but real quickly, we're astoundingly down to the last 10 minutes here. What is happening? You're in Boston. What is happening with the Plymouth nuclear plant at Pilgrim there and at Seabrook? What is the latest news on shutting them down?
Well, I think that the Pilgrim is on the way out, and you know, and the question is how fast it's going to go. You know, so that people want it shut, you know, immediately, and they're saying give us 2-3 years. You know, but basically, you know, it's a non-economic and poorly operated plant. It was always a non-economic and poorly operated plant. You know, it was the joke in the nuclear industry, you know, was that the, you know, that alcoholism was a big sport at Pilgrim, but, you know, that Vermont Yankee was run by more professionally. And, of course, you know, Vermont Yankee is gone.
Thank God.
And Pilgrim is going.
When will Seabrook go? When are we going to be done with Seabrook?
I don't see any short-term likelihood that that's going to happen.
All right. No. Well, that's too unfortunate, but hopefully it'll happen more quickly. So
I think one of the issues, you know, is, you know, to the degree of which, you know, subsidy keeps flowing into the nuclear industry, you know, so that it, you know, I mean, that's what they've managed, you know, that's been, you know, it's not, you know, for both coals and nukes and natural gas, you know, the government has been willing to save the companies from bankruptcy, or if they're allowed to go into bankruptcy, then another company just takes it over, you know, so that's typically what happens to the nukes, you know, so that, you know, as one owner says, I can't make money, I'll sell it to you. Well, someone buys it, you know, on the first purchaser pays like 30 cents on the dollar. And then the next purchaser pays, you know, 30 cents on that dollar. You know, so essentially you have them owning a thing that they just basically need to afford to buy fuel to run and to operate, you know, so that they don't have.
Oh, my God, we're over. Roy Morrison, Sustainability Sutra, thank you so much, Blue in New York. Get the book on Amazon. Roy, you've been a great guest. Thank you much.
Good, thank you. Sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.